Welcome to a, hopefully it's going to rain and a little bit of sunshine today. And this is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Our agenda today is a public hearing on House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services. Before we go into orientation, last Thursday, hearing the Commission on Children and Families budget, there was a lot of discussion about Oregon benchmarks and whether or not their performance measures tied into them. And you have in your handout today the Oregon benchmark data. It includes more than just the Commission on Children and Families, but it's a resource document that I think will be helpful as we go along this process. And also, I had asked Sheila, Ms. Baker, to give you a copy of the federal poverty guidelines, because often in our testimony, you hear from individuals who talk about poverty guidelines, and I thought it would be helpful for you if you had those guidelines. And you see there's two sides. It's the 2002 federal guidelines, and also on the flip side is 2003, and it provides you with the number of, in a family and what the gross yearly income and then monthly income, and then it also provides you with approximately what that hourly income depicts. And it's kind of interesting when you look there. For example, if you're making $8,860 a year with the $738 monthly income, that translates into $4.26 an hour, which is, as you know, below our minimum wage. And these figures come from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Just wanted to have that for you so you could have a reference point of when we go through the budget. With that, I also need to, just some housekeeping, if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, I would ask that you turn it off just so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And also, we haven't given a name to our little blue and white pig yet.
Ms. Piggy.
And but she's there. Miss Piggy is there. In order to do two things, one is to encourage or discourage the use of acronyms. And so for those who are witnesses and testify before us, they're asked to contribute to Miss Piggy so that the dollars that are collected at the end of session will go to Oregon Food Bank to help to feed the hungry. So in one instance, I'm asking you to kind of be not use so many acronyms, but also on the other hand, I may encourage you to do so that we may feed the hungry at the end of this process. So talk about contradictions. With that, Sheila.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
Yeah. Since you're trying to create a rosy picture when people's lives are hungry, I think Senator Porter has a wonderful name. Miss Rosie Piggy is her name.
Miss Rosie Piggy is her name. Is that agreeable to all the members on this panel?
To Miss Rosie. And would you tell them who the parliamentarian is?
The parliamentarian, to assure that you make sure you make your contributions, is Senator Margaret Carter. So, with that,
Madam Chair,
Senator Moore.
Can we buy season passes?
You can buy season passes. In fact, you are encouraged to do so. You know, I think what? You can take a cue from Representative Bates and myself, who began this with a large contribution because we knew that we would probably be guilty as we go through this process of repeating the alphabet soup. So if you're so inclined to make your contributions early, I would certainly appreciate it, and you can be as magnanimous as your wallet will allow.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Could you ask Senator Carter if she's decided what box seats cost as far as a season pass is concerned?
I think she's probably working on an appropriate amount.
Thank you. I look forward to buying that box seat. Thank you.
Okay.
Good evening, morning, afternoon. It's been a long weekend. Good afternoon, members of the subcommittee. We are starting the Department of Human Services budget today. We have scheduled 2 days for an agency overview, so it will be a very high-level overview that you'll hear in the next couple of days. We will then get into the individual program area discussions. Because of the reorganization of the department, those program areas are slightly different than this subcommittee has heard in the past, and we'll work through them under their new organizational structure in the budget. We would expect to start with the children, adults, and families area on Wednesday and then move through the rest of them. You should have in front of you a binder with agency overview. This is the material the agency will use as the basis for its presentation in the next 2 days. You also have a handout from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division summarizing the governor's budget for the agency as a whole. And I hope you brought with you the information that we had put into your offices from our office, the orientation and background information memo with a very short memo attached to it and some summary slides, and then our analysis of the agency budget as a whole. I'll walk through that very quickly so we can get to the budget presentation by the agency and Department of Administrative Services. On the first page of this, I just listed the statutory responsibility in ORS 409 for the department. And if you've taken a good look at this, you'll see that it's a lot of words. It's a lot of a scope of responsibility. Children and families, elderly persons, disabled persons, persons requiring financial assistance, institutional care, rehabilitation, or other social and health services, health and health-related affairs, mental health and developmental disabilities, vocational rehabilitation for persons with disabilities, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, addiction, chemical dependency problems, licensing and regulation of persons, facilities, and programs that provide health and human services, and then sort of the catch-all, other health and human services programs and functions delegated to the department by state and federal law. So you can understand when you look at this list why the scope of programs that the department provides is as broad as it is. I've listed on the next page the five program area clusters. The budget bill in front of you budgets the by program area clusters plus a line for capital improvements, a very small amount of money. But the operations of the division or the department are organized by these clusters. The general fund and lottery expenditures are only about a fourth of the total budget for this department. It's heavily federal funded. There's also a substantial amount of other funds. So about 26% of the budget is general fund and lottery funds. Other funds make up about 14% of the budget, and federal funds about 60% of the budget. And we'll talk more about those various funding sources as we get into the agency overview and then into the individual program areas. But I thought it would be useful to have a sense of where the major funding sources are. The next page shows that the largest share of this department's budget, 76% of it, in fact, goes to services for seniors and people with disabilities and health services, which includes public health, mental health, medical assistance, such as the Oregon Health Plan. So the largest components of the budget are in those two areas, children, adults, and families, and community human services, which is the field staffing piece, and then the department-wide support services make up only about 24% of the budget overall in terms of general fund and lottery funds expenditures. The next page shows that most of the expenditures in this department are special payments. Those are payments that go out to individuals, to providers, to counties, to other agencies for other services. So that makes up in the governor's budget for 2003-2005, almost 80% of the expenditures. Personal services, which is the staffing costs and related expenditures, salaries, PERS, unemployment compensation, those social security taxes are about 13% of their budget. Services and supplies, desks, pencils, paper, telephone, rent, makes up almost 8% of their budget. And then capital outlay, which is predominantly information technology expenditures, is less than 0.1% of their budget. I'll just hit at a very high level what the budget drivers are, because the department will address these in much greater detail as we're going through the next couple of days and as we're in the program area discussions. Obviously, growing numbers of elderly and disabled persons, given the level of services provided to those populations and the significant part of that budget, growth in that population drives budget expenditures. The economic climate, as we've seen with the recent economic downturn, demand for services increases as the economy declines in Oregon. And this is a factor not only in Oregon's budget, but, of course, nationwide. Healthcare costs and utilization are a big factor. Again, not only a local problem, but a national problem. The impact of alcohol, drug abuse, and cigarette use on program services and caseloads is significant, particularly in the areas of alcohol and drug abuse programs, but also in the areas of healthcare and child welfare programs. Federal policy and funding levels are another major factor. As I indicated, much of this budget is funded with federal funds. Those federal funds have a number of strings attached to them. There are federal policy requirements, federal program requirements, delivery system requirements in some cases, and in a number of the block grants, which suggest that they're relatively flexible money, there are maintenance of effort requirements in terms of the state's contribution outside of the block grant funding levels. So we'll hear about that over the next several months. And then the other factor I've listed there is litigation or the threat thereof. A number of the more recent budget drivers in this area have come from either litigation at a national level that's then pursued at a local level. For example, placement of people with mental illness or disabilities in the least restrictive settings as opposed to institutional care. Child welfare services. We have an existing agreement in lieu of litigation to provide a certain level and approach to child welfare services. Those are examples of the kinds of things that the department budget responds to. So that's, as I said, a very high-level overview there on those pages. There is a two-pager attached to that, which gives a little more information about the revenue sources, the budget environment, and then what's happened to this department's budget during this current biennium in terms of program and funding reductions. And then the governor's budget overall, what the impact for 2003-2005 is. So I'd be happy to answer high-level questions.
No high-level ones. And thank you. Jean. And welcome, Jean and George. Thank you, Jean. We appreciate your contribution.
There we go. Should take care of me for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry. Someone said I didn't gavel. I thought I did. I will gavel in the public hearing, just in case it wasn't heard the first time. I hope I hit it hard enough this time. This is the public hearing on House Bill 5030, and Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services, and with her is George Naughton, who represents Budget and Management Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services. This is the first of what I understand are about 2 months that you'll be spending.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? For individuals who are on the side of the aisle, there's six of you, if you would like to sit in the empty seats on the side here, you're perfectly welcome to do so. And there's also some seats right over here in there.
I believe you'll be spending about the next 2 months hearing about the budget and the programs of the Department of Human Services. So today and tomorrow, we just like to keep you at about the 20,000-foot level in terms of what it is that we do in the department. And there are four main areas that we understand you would like us to cover. What is it we do, and how do we go about doing it? What are our delivery systems? Where does our funding come from, and where does our funding go? Performance measures. How have we done, and how do we think our performance will be affected by the budget, the governor's balanced budget for 2003-05? And lastly, reorganization. As you may know, Governor Kulongoski specifically asked me to step back and take a look at whether mid-course corrections might be necessary on the department's reorganization. And so I would like to spend some time talking with you about how we're going about that, some observations that I have, concerns I have, and some of the things we're trying to do to address some of those. Let me jump right into it. You have a document here. I'll be kind of flipping back and forth through some of this. It won't especially go in as orderly a fashion. We're trying to follow both the budget instructions and then separately what it was that we understood that the committee wanted to do. Let's start with page one. Actually, the Department of Human Services, you'll see here our mission and goals. We are considered the state's health and human services agency. We're the largest agency in state government, and so probably the largest budget you'll be dealing with, unless you also happen to sit on the education subcommittee. Our mission is to assist people to become independent, healthy, and safe. And as you can see there are four primary goals for people to be healthy, for them to be living as independently as possible, for them to be safe, and to be able to support themselves and their families. As Sheila laid out for you, there are a number of program areas or services that we are statutorily directed to provide. And so we oversee health care for low-income Oregonians, child protection, public health, welfare to work, vocational rehabilitation, mental health, services for seniors and persons with physical and developmental disabilities. And so we'll start today with kind of walking you through generally those program areas and how services are delivered. And then as you move into various parts of the budget presentations and discussion over the next 2 months, you'll hear in more detail. If we can go to page five, I'd like to discuss our organization structure with you. And we have gone through a reorganization, and so the budget structure or the organization that you're used to dealing with is undergoing change. Actually, one of the things, we're kind of in a strange situation in 2003 because our budget structure still aligns with our old organizational structure. So as we've been dealing with reductions, with program reductions or across-the-board reductions, it reflects our old organization structure, and so we have to crosswalk with where we are today. Let me start, actually, though, with the three areas on the bottom. And we basically have three program areas that we are clustered around. And then we have a field structure and then other parts of the organization that support both our program, our policy, and the operations. Starting left to right, and again, I'll go into more detail as we move along. Children, adults, and families. This is basically the former policy offices for the former adult and family services and services to children and families. So deals with both self-sufficiency issues and child welfare issues. The assistant DHS director for children, adults, and families is Ramona Foley. And so as we finish up our overview, the next part of the presentation is for you to hear more about children, adults, and families, also known as CAF. And I will try not to say CAF, but I may. Secondly, we have health services. Mm-hmm. And health services is led by Barry Cast, as the assistant DHS director for that. This includes the former health division, which would include the public health functions, the former Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, the former and current Office of Medical Assistance Programs, so the portion of the department that administers the Medicaid physical health portion. It also includes the former mental health component of the former Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. And as part of this structure, you'll see that there are many positions there, and that's because we also, under this program or policy cluster, we operate state psychiatric hospitals, so namely primarily Oregon State Hospital in Salem, its campus in Portland, as well as a smaller facility in Pendleton. So out of the 2,300 positions in health services, about 1,400 of them are just for those institutions. So, again, we have basically the health, mental health, and Medicaid physical health components there. The third primary policy cluster is seniors and people with disabilities, and it's often referred to as SPD. James Taves is our acting assistant director for seniors and people with disabilities. This includes the former Senior and Disabled Services Division, so the former SDSD, the former Developmental Disabilities part of the former Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Services Division, and also a portion of what was our former Vocational Rehabilitation Division, the Disability Determination Services. This portion also includes a portion of the field structure, and it is the field structure that is actually operated through the county-administered portions, and much of the services to seniors and people with disabilities is operated through the counties. Again, we still have some state facilities that are part of this section, and so we have some state-operated group homes for the developmentally disabled and a facility still remaining in Pendleton for the developmentally disabled. So just between those two, that's over 800 positions. And then we have, again, some other areas that, when they're all done, add up to 1,600. Those are the three key areas, then, that we'll talk about in more detail in a moment. If you move up to the top charts, I'd like to move to Community Human Services, which is second from the left. This is basically the state employees who are part of the field structure. Most of the services that are provided through Community Human Services would relate to the former Adult and Family Services and the former Services to Children and Families. So most of the field staff really relate to our self-sufficiency and our child welfare efforts. We also, within Community Human Services, have our designated state unit for vocational rehabilitation. There are also some state employees in here who provide services for seniors and persons with disabilities. But basically, Community Human Services then carries out the policy that may be set through the three policy or program offices, in as much as there are state employees who actually carry that out. And as we go through some of these, I'll talk more about which of these services are primarily state-delivered, which are primarily county-delivered, and which are primarily delivered through private nonprofit providers. The other sections, then, really are sections that support the rest of the work of the department. So in administrative services, and again, I'll talk more about this later, you would have your facilities, your human resources, your information technology, contracting, those types of functions. On the right-hand side, finance and policy analysis is basically our budgeting shop. We have a very large budget, and I think as you'll see as we work through this budget, there are many interrelationships among these programs. And so at the central office, it allows us to look across the programs to better understand if we make a change in one area, how might that affect the budget in another area. Lastly, we have a small unit called the Continuous System Improvement. This section looks at providing the kinds of supports, whether it be primarily staff training, management training, research and evaluation, to assist us in managing our programs. And then we have the director's office that includes myself, our deputy, and some other functions, which, again, we'll discuss in a little more detail as we move into it. If we could move on to page 6, then, let me spend a bit more time talking about, over the next few pages, what it is we do and how the services are delivered. First of all, as I noted, children, adults, and families, we haven't come up with whether these are called clusters or groups. I'll call them clusters for lack of a better term. But we have brought together there the policy and the program direction around services that really are focused on helping low-income Oregonians become self-sufficient through employment and in providing safe and permanent homes for abused or neglected children. The first three bullets there really relate more to our self-sufficiency efforts. So we administer the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, which is TANF, and TANF is a federal term. This is the former, prior to federal welfare reform, we had aid to families with dependent children, the former welfare program. In the mid-90s, this became a federal block grant program and renamed federally. So it provides cash assistance to low-income families with children. Also provide through here food stamps, which are federally funded, although the administration of it is a 50-50 split with state and federal money. But the second bullet really relates to, we don't want to just provide cash assistance to low-income persons. What can we do to try to help them move from welfare to work? What can we do to try to help them become self-sufficient? And so, there are a number of program payments that are made through what we call our jobs program, training, other kinds of support services to assist people to become job ready, and then as they move into jobs to provide them with child care and other supports while they work to move up the economic ladder and to assist them to find and retain jobs. Lastly, we have prevention programs that we partner with many others on to address issues like teen pregnancy that may, in fact, increase the need for public assistance. The next several bullets really relate to the work that we do around child welfare or child protective services. So investigation of alleged child abuse or neglect, and if necessary, to intervene in those reports of abuse or neglect. Working on helping parents provide safe homes for their children. So connecting them with mental health services or other types of services that may be necessary to increase the safety or provide for the safety of children who may be at risk for abuse or neglect. Substitute care for when children do need to be removed from their homes. So foster care for children who are removed from their homes, and while they're in foster care, of working with the families to try to see what might be necessary and how might we work with the families so that we can reunite the child and the family. And lastly, adoption services for those instances where it appears that the family and the child will not be able to reunite, the services that may be necessary to help put them into a permanent home. These services at the children, adults, and families are carried out primarily through state staff in our field structure, our community human services structure, as well as with contracts with providers in our jobs program, individual providers such as daycare providers, foster parents, and other kinds of treatment services that may be necessary to assist families who have children who may be at risk of abuse and neglect. The second area here I'd like to discuss then is seniors and people with disabilities. As I noted earlier, this is the former SDSD, Seniors and Disabled Services Division, and also the former Developmental Disabilities portion of the former Mental Health, as well as Developmental Disability Determination Services. Most of these programs are actually delivered through local partners, through counties and other local government, as far as administration of the programs, but also beyond that with providers who may be nursing facilities or other types of providers. The focus in this portion of the department, it's primarily the Medicaid long-term care portion, or the long-term care portion of the federal/state Medicaid program. Again, focused on services for seniors and people with disabilities, whether they're physical disabilities or developmental disabilities. So we have abuse prevention, investigation of alleged abuse among seniors or disabled persons, licensing and monitoring of nursing homes and other facilities that would care for seniors and people with disabilities. The next two bullets really reflect the work that Oregon has done over the last 20 years in providing a continuum of care for seniors and persons with disabilities. Back in the early 80s, or up until actually the mid-80s, the federal Medicaid program would pay for people to receive services in a nursing home, but not for services that would keep them in a less restrictive environment. So services that might be provided in their own home or in another substitute care setting were not allowed. People had to be in bad enough shape that they needed nursing home care. Oregon was really a leader in first piloting a program in Southern Oregon to show that it was cost-effective to provide services and alternative living arrangements. And that then led to, in the mid-80s, a move by Congress to allow states to have what are called home and community-based care waivers under federal Medicaid program. I believe Oregon was the first or one of the first states to actually apply for that. And so we don't confine our assistance to people who are in nursing homes. We really look to see, is there a way? And most people who are elderly or person with disabilities don't want to have to go to a nursing home unless they don't have to. And so we really have focused on what kinds of choices can we provide to people to allow them to stay in their own home. And then if necessary and that they're no longer able to stay in their own home, are there other substitute care arrangements, such as adult foster homes or assisted living facilities? And then, of course, nursing homes, which are also have been the traditional form of Medicaid delivery of long-term care services. In addition, with the downsizing and then the closure of Fairview Training Center, we have moved our services for the developmentally disabled into the community. We continue to operate some. We have some state-operated group homes, primarily for those who have especially intensive needs, but also then have community supports for other persons with developmental disabilities, and that can include employment, residential care, and family support to help them stay within with caregivers or into a substitute living arrangement if necessary. On the next page, we continue a description of some of the other services that are administered through seniors and people with disabilities. Oregon, again, was one of the first states to receive a federal waiver that allows persons with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back a little bit, because you had mentioned earlier where there are legal issues, and you mentioned the DD booth. Mm-hmm. I think that this panel might be to know that there is a budget driver in this category as well, which is
and Madam Chair, thank you for mentioning that. And as I get a little further into the budget drivers, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But we have entered into an agreement in 2000 to serve developmentally disabled, a growing number of developmentally disabled people in the community. We've had for a number of years people on wait lists, and we're certainly, as other states have faced some very serious lawsuits, that we entered into an agreement to, again, expand coverage and the number of people developmentally disabled who could be served in the community. That lawsuit at this point, or that agreement, is certainly up in the air because of proposed reductions that are due to occur because of the loss of Measure 28 and also into 2305. We'll come back and, again, talk about some of those as we move further into this. As I was beginning to mention in seniors and people with disabilities, Oregon was one of the first states to receive a waiver in the late 90s that allowed persons with disabilities to take jobs but to continue to receive Medicaid coverage for services that in the past, in many cases, they had to make a choice between do I continue my Medicaid coverage so I can get assistance, especially severely disabled people, assistance with those needs, or do I take a job and lose that coverage? We are able to receive a federal waiver that allows severely disabled people to take jobs and still receive services that can assist them, because in many cases we may be paying for the kinds of supports that a traditional or commercial health plan might not be able to cover. And, of course, many people go to work for employers who don't offer even a traditional health care coverage. Lastly, in seniors and people with disabilities is our Disability Determination Services section. And this is 100% federal funds. We have state staff, again, paid for with federal funds, who actually make determinations for people who are applying for Social Security disability benefits. So whether they're applying for what is called SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which would be for lower-income persons who are elderly disabled. So there are a number of staff who go through following federal criteria, making these kind of determinations on behalf of the federal government. Our next area is health services. And in health services, we have combined the Office of Medical Assistance Program, the former public health programs that were run through the health division, and our mental health and addiction services programs. Let me start with and there are kind of three separate pieces that also interrelate. Let me start with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And this is the portion of the department which provides the Medicaid, basically physical health, or administers the Medicaid physical health program along with the Children's Health Insurance Program. Medicaid is a federal state program that's been in existence since the mid-60s. It's for certain low-income persons. There's a federal match. And so for every dollar of services provided, or Medicaid-eligible services provided to a Medicaid-eligible person, the federal government and our match rate changes, I believe, on a yearly basis, but they pay 60 cents of it and we pay 40 cents. There's some differential rates there. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which is an option that was made available to states in the late 90s, is for uninsured children, and our match there is about 72-28, so 72% federal, 28% state. There, we currently have about 400 or over 400,000 people enrolled in the health plan, and the health plan really encompasses kind of the traditional Medicaid, an expansion program that began in 1994 with our initial waivers, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Basically, the pieces I've talked about already under children, adults, and families, and seniors and people with disabilities, basically everybody who is served through those systems is also eligible for Medicaid health care services. And plus there are additional people here. So they may have been made eligible through one of these other programs, or they may have been made eligible as kind of a standalone health plan program. But the Office of Medical Assistance Program is responsible for the administration, the program policy development, the payment of claims that for people in this system. We also assist, again, with a federal match, paying Medicare premiums for low-income people eligible for Medicare. Medicare, as you may know, provides hospital coverage, Part A coverage. Part B coverage, which must be purchased by beneficiaries, would cover primarily physician and some ancillary services. And so we will pay the premiums for people who are low-income and Medicare eligible. What Medicare doesn't cover, probably most predominantly that you've been reading about in the papers, is prescription drugs. And so as you get further into discussions about the Medicaid program, about the cost of the health plan, you'll see that much of our cost, especially in the drug arena, is really on people who have both Medicare and Medicaid coverage. But since Medicare does not provide coverage for prescription drugs under the state Medicaid program, we pick up those costs. The second area...
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, Jean, correct me if I'm wrong, the Medicare... premiums we pay for these people is actually a cost savings for the state, because if we don't pay it, they probably become eligible for straight Medicaid, and I believe the Medicare payment that we pay is actually also partially paid by federal matched funds. Is that correct? I know it's a general cost savings for us. If we don't take care of these people this way, they'll come back at us on the Medicaid side, I believe.
Mr. Chair Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we have many people who are Medicaid and Medicare eligible. They are dual eligibles, we call them. And so if we don't pay for their premium, then we would have, and they don't pay for it themselves, we'd end up having to pay the physician's cost, for instance. But there are also other people who are not Medicaid eligible, and we are required by federal law to pick up their Medicare premiums, which means they can then access physician coverage. I don't know to what degree, because most of the people are on fixed incomes, whether or not they would ever drop down to the level of the income level of meeting Medicaid eligibility criteria. What they might do, though, is that I'm going to try to refrain from getting into a complicated discussion of Medicaid eligibility, but people could have higher income than normal Medicaid eligibility, but if they meet the criteria of having enough impairments, they'd be eligible for long-term care, then they become eligible for Medicaid long-term care and Medicaid health care coverage. So to the degree we can pay so they could access physician care, that may keep them from maybe moving into a place where they have more severe impairments that might move them into long-term care, then we are saving money. But it's not necessarily that everyone we would pay premiums for is necessarily the immediate cost savings to us. It's a fairly complicated interrelationship between Medicare and Medicaid, and you're probably sorry you asked after that.
Probably a lot more things I'll be sorry I asked later on.
Perhaps we would like to ask the federal counterpart up there for a more simpler, straightforward system.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I mean, frankly, if Medicare does move ahead with a prescription drug benefit, and if they're willing to then pick that up for people who are dual eligibles, that will pull off a significant amount of spending from the state Medicaid programs. Because the fact of the matter is, Medicare doesn't cover prescription drugs, and we do. And so that is a big cost to us. So if they do move that forward, that can be a significant cost savings to the state. The second area within health services is comprises those areas that were formerly a part of the health division, really our public health structure. And these are a little different from most of the rest of the services that we provide in the department, because they're really population-based. They're less a direct one-on-one service with a client than looking at what can we do to keep our state healthy or improve the health of our state. And they go about that through a number of functions. You have inspection and regulatory functions, so around drinking water systems, restaurants, regulation of ambulance services and hospitals, monitoring of lead and other toxic substances. So they also work closely with Department of Environmental Quality on some of these issues. Much of the work is really around monitoring and prevention of disease. So certainly monitoring and prevention of communicable disease, which is a public health issue. If communicable diseases aren't prevented, then we as a society certainly deal with the costs of that. But also looking at how can we prevent other chronic illnesses such as diabetes and heart disease to save long-term costs either to the public system or to individuals. What can we do to promote healthy behaviors such as reducing tobacco and quitting tobacco? And again, we've seen reduction in tobacco use over the years. And finally, we're actively, as you probably read the paper every day, lead agency in bioterrorism preparedness as we deal with some of the concerns. And there's a significant amount of federal funds that have been flowing to the state to help our state and our local health authorities prepare for potential bioterrorism. Another function our public health portion of health services provides is maintenance of vital records. Births, deaths, marriage licenses, et cetera, and then also analysis and research utilizing those data. We have family health services, some prenatal care, although that has really been severely, as we've increased the health plan and the use of Medicaid funds for that, the funding for prenatal care, general fund-only prenatal care, has been severely reduced over the years, but also the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, which is a federal program, and promotion and regulation of school immunizations. Lastly, in public health, we have a public health lab services that support infectious disease programs and screening of newborns. The third and last area in health services is mental health and addiction services. Much of this in the past, these were two separate offices before they've been brought together because in many cases people suffer from both mental health and addiction problems. Much of this work, or most of this work actually, is contracted out to county mental health departments and other local nonprofit organizations. We work in substance abuse prevention activities with other partners. We pay for outpatient and residential mental health and chemical dependency treatment. I noted earlier we still do maintain some state psychiatric facilities, most notably the Oregon State Hospital in Salem, down on Center Street. We have a Portland campus of the state hospital and also a smaller facility in Pendleton. And this is for those who can't be successfully treated in their own communities. And lastly, we work on prevention and treatment of problem gambling. So those are the three program areas, and what I'd like to do now is turn to our field structure, Community Human Services. As you know, we have been going through a reorganization, and that's why I've been trying to refer to the former AFS, the former Services to Children and Families. And as part of reorganization, really trying to focus on how can we better integrate services for clients on the front line, we have consolidated some of our separate field structures before. And so much, as I've noted, much of what we actually provide is provided through county government or local nonprofits or contracts with hospitals and medical care and other kinds of providers. But where we do have state employees who are in the field, we have combined them into Community Human Services. So we have more than 150 field offices across our state. Those are arranged into 16 service delivery areas, and those service delivery areas pretty much align with some of the similar kinds of service delivery areas from other parts of state government, such as the Employment Department and other parts of our workforce system. The service delivery areas, then, each of those managers has their own local advisory committee of community partners to really help advise those managers on how do we best bring together services locally. And even though we may be focused on state staff, those service delivery managers are really charged with also looking to see how can we better integrate our services with other county-operated programs, such as county health and mental health, and our area agencies on aging, which are the primary vehicles for administering services to the elderly and disabled. Separately, but part of Community Human Services is the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. This is an office that is through the federal government. We are required to keep as a designated, we need to have a designated state unit that focuses on the kinds of services that can assist persons with disabilities to become and to become employed and retain employment. We then have a series we've called department-wide support services, and that's what is necessary to maintain this service structure. That includes, first of all, the director's office. Our office provides overall leadership and really trying to move the agency forward and working with all of you and with our stakeholders. We include some policy analysis, not only internal audits, but also provider audits. So we have our Medicaid provider audits are actually not part of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, but are in a separate kind of arm's length office. We have a governor's advocacy office, which just has a handful of staff, I think three or four staff actually, who really help citizens in dealing with individual concerns. They have been overwhelmed this last month, I can tell you, in trying to deal with individuals who are losing coverage and trying to see what can be done to hook them up with other kinds of resources in the community. That office also operates our pain management program, which is a program I believe was passed, I believe it was either the 1999 or the 2001 legislature, to raise awareness about chronic pain issues. Lastly, in the director's office, we have a tribal liaison who works with the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon around issues of, for instance, child welfare and health and other social services. The second portion of administrative services, really of department-wide support services, is administrative services. As part of our reorganization, we have centralized many of the functions that were split into 7 divisions and however many 2 or 3 program offices before. And so instead of having each division or cluster have its own human resource policy, for instance, we have brought together human resources staff, the information technology staff, contracts, et cetera, to see how can we have more consistency and more efficiency across the department in those administrative service functions that really support the work that we need to be carrying out throughout the department. So this section also then takes the lead on some of the cross-departmental issues, such as I have to always look down and say, what does HIPAA stand for? There's a Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which is a huge, huge act that public and private providers are in the process of implementing as we speak. And this has major implications for the department in terms of privacy and security and consistency and they have codes and transactions so that if a medical provider is billing in Oregon, they're using the same codes as if they're billing in Wisconsin. And this is a national effort and then a major effort that's being carried out within each state, and administrative services is on point for this for us in the Department of Human Services. We then have finance and policy analysis. I mentioned it's basically our budget shop. Again, we had separate budget staff for our different divisions. And one thing I think you'll find is as you get further into the department, you can push one way and have it or take something away one place and have it pop up someplace else. There's an interrelatedness of our programs and services that is difficult to understand and get your arms around at times. And so, for instance, as we get further into discussions around how does one is carry on the discussion, I started with Representative Bates, as someone may lose their Medicaid eligibility for long-term care, they may also lose their Medicaid eligibility for the health plan, or maybe they won't. And so we need to make sure that the budget and the fiscal staff recognize those interrelationships so that as we're making reductions or additions in different parts of our programs, we understand the offsets that may occur. And frankly, as we've gone through these series of reductions over the last few months, many times what has happened is that a proposal may have been looked at from one perspective and seen to be saving money, but because of federal requirements, it would have cost us more someplace else in the department. So the finance and policy analysis shop really tries to make sure we're on top of those linkages and as possible. The caseloads are forecast and the cost per case are forecast out of this shop. We include rate setting functions there for nursing facilities and some other long-term care and also for a managed care functions. Lastly, we have a small unit of about 20 staff called Continuous System Improvement. And I'll say right now, because by the time you get to this portion, which is near the end of our budget presentations, this unit will probably no longer be in existence. It is a small unit that was put together to really facilitate reorganization. And much of what the unit does at this point is training, management training for line staff around process improvement, research and evaluation, performance measurements. We are looking at this, and our cabinet, the assistant directors, were visiting this and looking to see, of these functions, which of them are most critical to us doing our core business right now. And I will say I am certainly not a person who says that we can't afford, that we have budget cuts, so we can't afford training. When you're having budget cuts, that may be the time, depending on what the training is, that you need it more than ever, so that staff know how to do their job, to do it in the most efficient way. But we need to look very closely here at what we are doing, given the scope of the kinds of reductions we are making. We need data. We need performance measures. We need to know where we are going on a quarterly basis and more often. How do we use that data? How do we gather that data? So we want to continue much of the functions that are in this. We're looking at it closely to see which of these are most critical to our core work. But we will likely then take some of those pieces that we decide upon and put them into some other parts of the administrative structure so we no longer have a standalone, which will also save us some positions and some funding there.
Questions? Thank you, Madam Chair. That little department, or whatever, cluster, beg your pardon, has 21 positions. Mm-hmm. Do you foresee those 21 positions being absorbed throughout the rest of the DHS budget?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we have about 12 of those are in training and organizational development. At this point, I don't think it's an issue of absorbing. I think that by the time we are done, that we will likely reduce some of the positions. But if the function isn't carried out here, it won't be absorbed somewhere else. Okay. But what we're basically trying to say is, can we reduce some of the top administrative layers that we have and potentially reduce some positions as well?
Follow-up, Chair? That would certainly be my preference, to absorb the functions, and I know these are human bodies in these jobs, and I don't mean to be hard, but that is exactly where we need to look at savings. Thank you.
Great. What I'd like to do now is actually turn you to Appendix A, which is behind the tab that says Appendix, to
Madam Chair,
if I may attend the board.
Thank you. Ms. Thorne, before we go there, I do have a question about the Governor's Advocacy Office. Can you give us a feel for the volume of calls being received now? Is that office working extended hours? Just give us a sense of what's happening there.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I know somewhere in here I have the data. I think we have four or five, we have some staff on job rotation there. They have been overwhelmed. The last couple of months. We have been trying to suggest to clients that they should work with their case managers in the field as well. But I think maybe somebody here behind me can dig out. It's an enormous, I want to say 20-some thousand calls. I can't remember over what time period that is. But they certainly have been working extended hours. They're pretty frazzled right now. We're looking to see, having discussions tomorrow, to see if we can provide some additional support from some other parts of the department. But they are the kind of the key place where the calls are coming in. They are working, for instance, the staff of that office are working with OHSU and trying to identify where there are transplant patients who may no longer have their anti-rejection medications covered. And between OHSU and that staff, trying to find are there other sources out there. One of the things, for instance, that they found in a couple of instances is that the person actually had Medicare coverage prior to their transplant, and so Medicare will pick up 80% of the costs of their anti-rejection medications for a period of time. But trying to link them up with some of the other programs that you've discussed before, the free and discount programs. So this, yes, they're working nights, they're working weekends. I sometimes see copies of emails from 10, 11 o'clock at night that are being sent out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
On Appendix A, we just have three charts that we didn't want to get into detailed caseload information because you'll see that as you get into the more detailed parts of the department's presentation. But we thought these might be interesting just for you to look at from an overall perspective of what is happening, what has been happening in terms of the amount of volume of work that the number of clients the department sees and where we're seeing them, what kinds of services we're seeing them receive, and geographically. And so as you can see, just in 1998 versus 2000, well, just look at the difference between 2000 and 2001. Being an agency that primarily serves low-income and at-risk people, as the economy begins to tank, our workload goes up.
Yeah.
And so as people lose their jobs or lose the number of hours they may have had or lose other kinds of health benefits, for instance, they will turn to us. And so just as the revenue is decreasing, our workload is increasing.
Can you tell me, these numbers are astounding, can you tell me what's the ratio of caseload to workload?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, there's probably about a one-pager because every program is different. You may have a very simple program of eligibility that may be one case to 300. You may have a child welfare caseload that may be more, maybe 1 to 15 or 20, where it's more direct hands-on. So as you get into these, I think you'll see, as you get into the more detailed presentations, you'll see the staffing standards that accompany. But here's an interesting statistic that someone in our shop uncovered a couple of weeks ago, because we'd been queried on kind of how had the Department of Human Services budget grown over the years. And so he went back and he looked at our caseloads, our budget, and our staffing. And he did a pretty good apples-to-apples comparison to the, I think it was the 81-83 biennium. Now, remembering that the Department of Human Resources at that time still had corrections, still had employment, still had juvenile corrections. Mm. He pulled all that out. So we were looking more at the services we provide today. And to try to give a sense of how our caseloads had increased, well, first of all, we had 20 years ago, we had about 9,400 staff. Today, we have about 9,400 staff. Our Medicaid caseloads, which is, as you'll see as we get here further, which is our most heavily used program and probably is kind of the best predictor of overall usage, has quadrupled during that time. I think that as we talk about internally, without going back and spending a lot of time doing further analysis, because we don't have time to do that right now, I think there are a number of things that have occurred over the years as you look back. We've had many of the staff back in the early 80s were running Fairview Training Center, the state hospitals, damaged state hospital. And so as we have moved from institutional settings to more of a community-based setting, those community-based providers are primarily private nonprofits. We have also devolved many of our functions to local government. And so in the early 80s, we handled seniors and disabled services, Medicaid eligibility, long-term care eligibility ourselves. Now most of that is handled through counties. And so we've moved more and more, for instance, as we, the Office of Medical Assistance Program does its own claims, does claims processing. And so that's for all the fee-for-service claims. As we move to managed care, that meant we could have absorb more and more because we make one payment to a managed care plan as opposed to processing individual claims. So we could absorb the increase in workload without adding staff and, in fact, by reducing staff. But I think part of what we'll probably be starting to discuss with you over the next couple months is as we do things like kind of the more recent actions will mean a decrease in managed care. We're not staffed up to handle the claims processing that comes back. So we have had, I mean, if you look at the early 80s versus today and try to do apples to apples, we certainly have had some huge increases in the number of people we serve. We haven't had an increase in the number of staff, and I think it really speaks to some of the changes in how services are delivered. But as you can see, again, as our economy has gone bad the last couple of years, we've had more of use of DHS services. The second part,
Senator Shields.
Before you leave this particular graph, you've gone from 847,000 to 944,000 unduplicated.
Yes, that's in the
headcount.
Mm-hmm.
An important point.
Yes.
Okay. My other question is, obviously, during this time you had a census taken. Is that asking myself mm-hmm. which end of the census is the latter figure based on? And I guess you will get to it.
I will get to Madam Chair and Senator Shields. I actually have some data in a couple charts that compares population with a census population with the utilization of services. I don't have it going back far enough to be able to show whether this has grown with the population, but I think that I don't think we had that big, if you look at 2000 to 2001, we didn't have that kind of growth in number of people in the state during that time.
Representative G. Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Gene, following on Senator Shields' question, with 944,000 unduplicated counts, that's about one in four, mm-hmm. under one in four Oregonians receiving service from the Department of Human Services. What's your interpretation of why that's the case?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, actually, as I get to another couple of these next charts, maybe I can try to come to some conclusions or maybe at least some tentative ideas, but maybe I can walk you through some of this. But I do think one thing you'll see is a heavy utilization of health plan benefits and self-sufficiency benefits. And I think that, again, we've seen our food stamp caseloads go up, our health plan caseloads, and our temporary assistance and need family caseloads go up. Those are all tied. Those all have income eligibility criteria. And I think as we see more people dropping in to being in poverty or in low income with either loss of jobs or moving to, we know now we have a growing gap between the lowest wage earners and the highest wage earners. And I think with the economy, because so much of what we do is benefit driven, that may be where, and you'll see from some of these, that is probably driving much of the increased utilization, increased numbers over the last couple of years.
A follow up.
I'm not sure, again, I'm not an economist. Can we base this on the economy? Because when you go back and look at 2000, granted there's a large increase, but it's not so significant that that's still not an outstanding number that just 2 years ago, 847,000 Oregonians, again, about one in four Oregonians were recipients. So I guess as you go forward, I would hope that you'd give us your interpretation of why we have so many folks receiving benefits from DHS.
And I think, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, there are some areas that I don't know if we took this back further. There are some policy changes that were actually made that actually come before 1998, I believe. So, for instance, the legislature chose to move into the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is was Congress made available, was funded through one of the tobacco tax increases, and we now have somewhere 40 to 50,000 children, or maybe even higher than that, covered that we didn't have before. So there have been some, and that was either 97 or 98. So there have been some policy choices made. We have not, as I'm trying to think off the top of my head, beyond that, done any other kind of major expansions of eligibility. It's basically we've kept eligibility the same, but have more people coming in.
Jean, could you provide us with, you know, some of the policy drivers? You know, the CHIP, I think that we expanded the food stamp outreach was another one that was a policy driver that was done by this body. So it would be helpful for them to have some of those decisions that were made by this body as we go through. Okay. Representative Bates and then Senator Shee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to comment that I think most of the things that have changed the last 2 years are caseload increases because of both policy and the recession. Mm-hmm. In combination, I think it raises up about 100,000. Jean, you said a couple of things that I wanted to hear more about. One was that one of your staffers put together a picture of how things have changed since the late or early 1980s to now as far as your staffing was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I was intrigued by that because I'm going to intuitively guess that most of the increase in load for DHS has been in the health plan.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't take a lot of hopefully that does not take a lot of department effort because most of the work being done there is by people in the field, physicians and hospitals. But a lot of people are impacted. And the other change was we closed down Fairview and other places, which opened up a lot of positions too, but they're also not in the field. I'm curious to know what actually changed as far as administrative personnel from then to now. Not just number of people working. If you can tweak those numbers out, even
we can, Madam Chair, Representative Bates. We can certainly do that. Just a couple of things I'd like to respond to, though. On the health plan, we still have to have staff actually make people eligible. So if we've quadrupled our number of people from going from 100,000 to 400,000, the delivery of the services, the actual seeing the physician, the hospital, those payments are still a payment that's made out. But the staff to actually process the eligibility has to increase with that. On Fairview Training Center, although we still continue to have some state-operated facilities, much of that is really has moved to local nonprofits. And but we can take a look and see if we can pull out a little bit more what might have driven some of those reductions.
Jean, along that line, would you, there's been quite a discussion on the state-operated versus the private. Could you also give us a percentage of what is state-operated and what percentage is private? And as near as you can, it's kind of interesting as we go through some of this discussion of talking about, well, the services being delivered at the local level, will we never really get what's involved as far as staffing and what have you in the local level to really get a full picture of how many bodies are we talking about. And I know in some instances it may not be possible, but where it can be possible so we can link up between what the state is doing and the local community is doing. Is that kind of what you're looking for, Representative Bates?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Can I have a follow-up question?
Representative Bates.
One last follow-up, too, and this is more of a point to be made, but maybe it's something you can bring to us when you look at the long-term changes, DHS. For many parts of the state of Oregon, the economy has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. We no longer have high-paying jobs with good benefits. Outside of the Portland area and Eugene area, many parts of the state never recovered from 1981 and 82. And many people, when they went back to work at low-paying jobs without benefits. And one of the benefits of the Oregon Health Plan was to allow people to go back to work and still keep a health mm-hmm. benefit. You may want to factor that into. My understanding is the high point in Oregon for the average working man was about 1979. It's been a steady downhill decline in buying power for the average Oregon worker since that time. We have a two-class society we've developed here. I think that's affected some of the things we're seeing here, where we have one person in four getting services from the state. I'd be curious about how many families that accounts to. I mean, one in four is one thing, but there might be several people in the same family getting benefits. And I would guess it's one family in three that receives benefits or something of that nature. That'd be an interesting thing to look at also.
And I think, Madam Chair and Representative Bates, we'll see if we can get at that, but I think one of the charts I'm going to show you in a moment actually may illustrate also, when we look geographically at where the highest utilization of services is occurring, I think you'll see it may not be in the areas that people would normally have thought you would see a high utilization of services, and it may relate back to changes in the economy.
Senator Shields.
Yes, Jean, as Senator Winters and others have asked for the drivers that may have affected this number that I raised questions about, if you're going to look at policy changes that may have raised that number, I think it's fair to look at policy changes that may have lowered that number earlier. For example, when we went to a block grant on welfare and it became TANF, it became one of the goals, I think, of the Department of Human Services to ride the number of people on TANF from about 50,000 down to 15,000. I can remember when I was on the Welfare Review Commission, what it was called then anyway, and each month we had a report of the declining number of people on TANF as each month passed. And I remember that going down, so that ought to be reflected mm-hmm. in here, too, if you create a chart that maybe begins, and the logical place maybe to begin it would be with, quote-unquote, welfare reform
mm-hmm.
forward. Because even as I look forward, and I know I'm cheating, I looked at the breakdown of your
thou shalt not cheat. Yeah, well, it'll cost you in that little bank there.
Well, right here, some money.
The price of doing business. But if you look forward, you end up with TANF a couple pages ahead, where you have 36,000 and 92,000 people respectively reported. I'd just like to kind of remind us that it was both policy changes up and down,
mm-hmm.
and that ought to be reflected.
Yeah, and Madam Chair and Senator Shields, what I'll try to do, because we have the overview today and tomorrow, if there are some of these data that we can get between today or tomorrow, but otherwise what we'll do is ask the program offices to be prepared to discuss specifically, you know, going back and looking at, for instance, post-welfare reform, what's happened with our caseloads and who is on those caseloads.
Yeah.
So we'll try to...
Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, that's probably, it went down, but in this recession, how much did it rebound?
Yes. And you'll see it coming back up as well. The next chart, which is, it's labeled calendar year 2001, number of people receiving DHS services. And this is an unduplicated, the first number is the one unduplicated count. So it's in the course of 2001, how many individuals received a DHS service during that time. And you'll see there are 944,000. But then what you'll see is some sense, and these, some people received services in two or three or four of these categories, some received in one. But what you'll see is some sense of, out of that 944,000, how the utilization of services breaks out.
Question. So, Representative Smith, TSIP.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry to interrupt. You don't have the figures in for 2002 yet, do you?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith.
Well, I would think they would be more.
I think they probably will be, but I think what we are trying to do here is give some sense
right,
of how it's broken out.
When would you expect to have those figures?
Madam Chair, I and Representative Smith, I don't know. I'll have
okay.
to find out.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm sitting here taking notes, assuming actually someone behind me, I hope, is taking notes.
I heard yes.
Okay, then I don't need to take as many notes. As you'll see, though, in looking at calendar year 2001, out of those 944,000, 67,000 received some type of alcohol and drug service. So 7% of people receiving services received alcohol and drug services. And then you'll see within alcohol and drug a mix. So as you'll see, the case management and treatment, everyone who received treatment received case management, but you have some sense of how services were used within there. In child welfare, 9.6% of people receiving services.
Is there a way to get a figure? You know, I know that these are the contacts of the service within each one of the categories. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to also pull out of there how many of them fall in multiple categories, for example? You probably already have it in here.
Madam Chair, we don't have it in here, but that is exactly a discussion we had with our staff who work on this the other day. And that is, I think, somewhere around, I want to say, the figure that had been thrown around a lot was either 60% or 80% of clients received two or more services. Well, that, I think, is somewhat a deceiving figure, because if you're on TANF, you automatically get food stamps and you get health plan. So that's three services. What we did ask staff to go back, though, and look at is once you pull the benefits out, the benefit side, and we really, and it's part of the issue of looking at and re-looking at reorganization. Where do we really have, or what, I asked them, what are our top 10 pairings of services or triplings of services? Where is it that we are seeing that people are receiving different services that may be case managed? So when we look at the issue of are people having multiple case plans or multiple case managers, which I think really is at the heart of service integration, we want a better indication of where are those linkages occurring. But then there was a follow-up question, and the concern of the staff who came and presented to us laid out is that this is a more intensive and research-oriented discussion, which is where are there pairings we would assume there should be more of based on research that we know of, but they aren't there. And so where is it that we think that based on national research that people should be receiving services that link and that maybe they aren't? And so there's kind of two levels we're looking at. First of all, when you actually look at how many, you know, developmentally disabled are receiving child welfare services at the same time, that's one question. But then if we think based on other information we have that more should be, how do we identify those? So we don't only want to look at what has been occurring, but what should be occurring.
Senator Courtney.
Thank you. In that line of questioning, we would want to know, for example, looking at the mental health category, how many of the mental health outpatients have a dual diagnosis? Mm-hmm. And do we know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a real question for now. Yeah. Do we have that broken out someplace?
I, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I think when we start to look at the linkages of how many, yeah, what it would answer is how many are receiving mental health and alcohol and drug treatment.
Right.
It may not answer how many more were out there who should have received and that we have not identified as dual diagnosis.
And that's my specific question, is how many have a dual diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's different from how many may be receiving one or both services, or both services.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we'll see what we do have or what we can pull together, and if not addressing it tomorrow, I'll be able to address it by the time you get to that portion of the budget discussion.
And an additional question, Madam.
Follow up.
Under the alcohol and drug category, the listing for maintenance, is that methadone?
I believe it would be, yes.
It would be.
Okay. While we're on my favorite subject, I did request a clarification on the methadone treatment, whether or not that the agency was following statute, and that is statutes say that you must provide detox and other treatment before you provide maintenance. and I have not had a response back from the agency. So would you follow that one for me? Because I think it is very important that we're, you know, moving to actually getting people treated and off of drugs, and that we're not finding ourselves in just doing maintenance as keeping individuals on drugs for an inordinate amount of time. So I would appreciate a follow-up on that request. I wasn't aware until my staff started doing some research that it is statutorily required that the agency performs, that we treat first, and we try to look at detoxing and getting the person off before we go into methadone maintenance.
Okay. So we'll certainly follow up.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. Will we be able to see the breakdown in terms of total dollars expended in the same categories that we are looking at here?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I don't think we have that broken down in today's presentation. You will be seeing it as we move along in the future presentations. There are pieces of this we may have in here already today as I move further into this.
Mm-hmm. Just follow up. Mm-hmm. Will we see it in a format like this to where we can look at the distribution of use and the distribution of dollars?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I mean, we'll strive to have it be something that looks similar to this. We may have it. I'm not sure if we do or not. So, but we will try to do that.
Gene, just another piece to make a little more. On case management, and my question of that is the length of the time of the case. You know,
Madam Chair, are you? Is there a specific one?
Well, I'd like to get into some average. You know, hopefully, we're not having in case management or where we have cases open forever that they're never closed. Mm-hmm. I used to say that when I was over, that somehow as caseworkers we're supposed to be working ourselves out of business, that we were supposed to be working in order to resolve problems to a point mm-hmm. where you no longer continue to have the case. And so particularly when I look at alcohol it may not happen in developmental disabilities, but, you know, there's some of these categories that hopefully you're resolving enough of the family's problems and those issues that no longer becomes an active case.
Madam Chair, I can ask as the assistant directors come in to be specifically prepared to talk with that, because there are some areas such as developmental disabilities and probably on long-term care.
Long-term
as well,
care.
They will continue. They're not going to get better. I mean, they're not going to move off in most cases, but
they can move into an inactive status mm-hmm. to where they're not actively work cases. And so I want to distinguish between that which is an active case and those things that are inactive.
Okay. We'll ask that our assistant directors be prepared to discuss that with you. In looking more at this, I think what you'll see on this particular chart is that the biggest utilization of services is health insurance, the Oregon Health Plan. So two-thirds of those who received services in 2001 received basically the Oregon Health Plan. And as we get further into what drives some of our spending, and you see the increasing cost of health care, which is not just a public sector issue, that certainly is one of the major drivers. But I hope this gives you some sense of where kind of the various services that are being received for clients throughout the department. The last chart in this appendix is calendar year 2001, and its percentage, it's DHS clients broken out by county and then aligned against population statistics. And the researcher this morning gave me this detailed explanation, which I am going to try to repeat to you. Almost 4 million, just barely short of 4 million shown as population, is not census data, because what they try to do is look at birth, deaths, in migration, out migration, to try to get a sense of, because just as our clients move in and out, they are born, they die, and trying to get a sense of how many people were in the state and in each county, and then of that, how many by county may have received services from DHS in calendar year 2001. And in some ways, in looking at this, it goes back to, I think, an observation that Representative Bates made. What you'll see is the state as a whole, about one in four, 23.6% of Oregonians received a service from DHS during 2001. But you'll see that on the low end, the three counties that had less than 20%, so you've got Benton at 15.8, Clackamas at 15, and Washington County at 14.1. On the other end, though, there are a number of counties that had greater than 30% of their population received services during 2001. And they are counties, as you look through them, in many cases that may have been affected by the change in the economy, in the makeup of the economy. And so Baker with almost 32%, Coos with 33%, Douglas 31%, Harney 32.6%, Jefferson 35.6%, Josephine 33.6%, Klamath 33%, Lake 32%, Lincoln 32%, Malheur 32%. And so just as we've seen our unemployment figures being high in some of those counties, and this very much mirrors when I was first back when we started the health plan and I was the director of OMAP, we looked at it by county and we're really surprised. We shouldn't have been, but surprised to see some of the counties that had the highest percentage of population actually utilizing those services. And I think it also that you see here, there is variation. And in many cases, they're rural, they're coastal, they're eastern counties where you have DHS and the services DHS provides is really being supportive of a substantial percentage of the population of the county. What I'd like to do is kind of finish up with that as being kind of the program description and now move on to the money, where it comes from, where it goes. And actually, if you keep going back, there's an Appendix C, which doesn't have a tab, but if you make your way back, you'll see it says expenditures and revenue. And we'd just like to take a couple of minutes going over some pie charts and then come back to a discussion on our major budgetary drivers and issues and probably wrap that, if we can wrap that portion up today, and then finish tomorrow with performance measures and reorganization. If you found the first pie chart, which is total fund expenditures by area, one of the things that I think is interesting, it was kind of surprising to me listening a few months ago before I came back to the department, and I think it's surprising to other people as well, about 80% of our budget goes out to in payments to clients, to whether it's in terms of benefits. So you've got whether it's TANF grants, food stamps, for instance. It may be payments to counties for operation of our programs, such as the area agencies on aging, or for actual provision of services, mental health, public health. And also significant amount that runs through the Oregon Health Plan, so to providers such as hospitals, physicians, pharmacies, et cetera. Money that goes out to long-term care providers, be it nursing homes, assisted living, client-employed providers, individual, foster parents, child care providers. So most of the DHS budget, even though we have, a lot of employees, isn't to support those employees, it's in payments that go out to people in the community, whether it's clients or providers or local government. So about 80% of our costs actually are on payments that go out. And you can see here then kind of the split beyond that of our department-wide support, our field service structure, our state-operated services, and that includes our state hospitals, state group homes, and then the population-based services, which are kind of the health division type of service. If you look at the second chart, which is major revenue sources for 0305, about an $8.5, $8.6 billion total fund budget for 0305, but the general fund is only about a quarter of that. Now, I think what's even more interesting is when you dig down deeper in terms of where that general fund goes, 87% of our general fund is either to match, provide match for federal programs, or maintenance of effort for federal programs. We only have 13% of our dollars that are unmatched, which when we start looking at what the choices may be, and I know we hear, you know, if you're cutting that program, you're losing federal dollars as well. Well, that's about it for almost every part of the department. We have leveraged a lot over the last few years. Other funds may include recoveries, estate recoveries, pharmaceutical rebates, but also includes tobacco taxes, tobacco settlement money. So part of what you have in other funds really is something that could be similar in terms of state funds that can be used as match.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Gene, we recently took a loan out on the tobacco settlement, which was other funds.
Mm-hmm.
How has that impacted this revenue source?
I believe that we had we don't have tobacco settlement in. Okay. There's no tobacco settlement for 03
or 05. Budget, there's no tobacco settlement dollars.
And follow up.
Madam Chair, we do have the tobacco tax in here, mm-hmm. but not the tobacco settlement. How much was that annually, and biannually? Was it $100 million annually and $200 million biannually?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we had in 0103 about $200 million of tobacco settlement funds in DHS for 0103, and that went down to zero. We had about $300 million of tobacco tax in 0103, and that's up to $400 million. Actually, I think it was lower than that. Let me check. I know the number for 0305 is $400 million. For tobacco tax funds. Let me check on 0103 and give you the exact number.
And, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
To put that in perspective, the 25% roughly represents about $900
million? It's about
$2
billion.
25%
too.
How much?
It's about $2 billion. $2 billion general fund for the department as a whole.
For 0103?
For 0305.
For 0305, we're say that one more time. I'm sorry.
It's about $900 million a year, isn't it?
Oh, a year.
Okay. I'm sorry, a year, yes.
Yeah. Well,
our general fund budget is about $2
billion. Gotcha. Right. Okay. Thank you, Manager.
It's 2.5?
Okay,
thank
good.
You,
thank goodness there are enough budget people.
I want to make that clear. Thank you.
They're going down to the decimal points now over here.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. The general fund budget in the governor's budget is $2.2 billion. So that's the base.
Okay. Federal funds, as you'll see, is about 60%, and it really breaks out, and I won't go through the following pages, but there are programs that require match, there are block grant programs, and then there are some programs that require no match and maybe 100% federally funded. So, for instance, the Women, Infants, and Children program is 100%. The food stamp program is 100% federal funds, but the administration requires a 50% match.
Gina, are they having any thought about maybe they can do a 60-40 or 75-25? Are you getting any indication from the federal government that they're being anywhere generous on some of that particular match?
Madam Chair, I haven't heard of anything now. And the guy who would know this stuff is sitting behind me. He said no, so I guess that means they're not. There are certain block grants we have, such as temporary assistance to needy families, child care, social services block grant, et cetera. But in most cases, we actually have a match. So I think I mentioned earlier in Medicaid, it's about a 60-40 match. For every Medicaid-eligible service for a Medicaid-eligible person, the federal government will pay 60 cents and we pay 40. We got to come up with our 40 cents. We can't get the money unless we come up with our share. The Children's Health Insurance Program is a 72-28. So, again, we got to come up with our 28 cents in order to get the 72. The second major category under federal matched is foster care and adoption assistance. Again, about a 60-40 match. We have vocational rehabilitation, which is an 80-20 match. And then when you get in administrative functions, it's all over the place. I mean, some of these it's 50-50, some in some cases 75-25. But that'll give you a sense of kind of the variety of the match.
Question, are there any restrictions, and I'm thinking about both in foster care as well, foster care particularly, where maybe the foster parent would want to cover the child under his or her own insurance. Are there some federal restrictions or some restrictions that we may have that
disallows that?
Madam Chair, we'll need to find out about
that.
Because
about
I think we have done that. I mean, they are technically would be normally foster care eligible under Medicaid, but we'll need to get back to
that. You know, in some of the discussions that we've had since our budget crisis, there have been, you know, all kinds of contacts, communications coming in, and one was where the foster parent, I believe it was foster parent, had stated that they would have been agreeable to covering the child under their insurance coverage. So, you know, I didn't know whether technically that they could, and also if there's any prohibition, particularly for the medically fragile child that is under the adoption program. So if you could check those two for me, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Certainly. The last pie chart there, just again, as you can see, I think Sheila kind of covered it in her overview. Once you get health services and seniors with people with disabilities, that's the bulk of our budget there. And so, and again, I think as you, most of our federal funds are Medicaid, and that really supports both of these areas. What I would like to do is go back to page 14 and just talk a bit about some of the budgetary drivers, and we can probably then call it quits for the day. The good thing about federal funds is, boy, they go a long ways to help us provide services. And as I said, we claim a lot of federal funds. The bad things about federal funds is then that means you follow their rules of what you can and you can't do.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I just want to make a quick comment about federal funds.
Mm-hmm.
It's our money.
Yes.
We send it to them. We give them a dollar. We get 85 cents back. Okay. Thanks.
You know, Representative Bates, and I can recall when I was sitting on the other side where Jean is, and there was the policy then, really, that said we would only accept the federal dollars if it was something in which the state actually, it was their policy and it was something that we wanted to do. Because Jean said something interesting, because once you take the federal dollars, we then are bound by their hoops, and whether or not we want to be puppets is another piece of it. And so it's prudency that says we may or may not agree with whatever program that the federal government comes down the pike. And we've become very, very dependent upon the federal government and their, even though it is technically our money. But until they do block grant funding, if they're hearing me back there in Washington, so that gives us a little more discretion on how we utilize those dollars, they're like pulling the strings. Go ahead, Jean.
Madam Chair. I think that, we have in Oregon have not been shy in challenging the federal government through waivers and have been known for that, to be groundbreaking in a number of fronts with waivers. But even with waivers, then, there are strings. They may be different strings, but there are strings. And certainly as we've gone through this, the latest, we have $140 million general fund of reductions. We're taking the last 5 months of this biennium. We basically have had to look at what can we do under federal law, what must we do under federal law, and in some of our areas, such as in seniors and people with disabilities, where our entire program is run on waivers, as is the health plan, we get into extended discussions and negotiations with the federal government. And so it does. Our reliance on federal revenues also means that the choices aren't all ours, that we have to work as, certainly I always have to try to look at, in my approach to the federal government, how locals may feel about the state as well. And as we, as state government, may make monies available to local government, we usually put strings on it for some reason, too. And so it is all of our tax money, but we then have, once we get into that game, we then have to play by those rules.
Senator Shields.
Just one more little point, and maybe I've missed this along the way somewhere, but I've watched us go up and down and up and down with regard to, match rates and matching funds for various dollars here and there. And have you seen a situation or a scenario in the last umpteen years where at one point we had a match rate on a particular program and then it got cut because we cut our portion Okay, and then later we were able to go back and restore money, but by the time we restored money, the match rate had changed, and we ended up losing. Is there a danger that when you cut general fund at one point and lose federal funds, when you restore, you won't get as much back because something's changed, or are they ever punitive? Either one of those two questions.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, since I've been around for umpteen years as well, I think
I don't want to tell them how many.
Well, I spent the last few years outside Human Services. I think the one thing that jumps to my mind, and I'm sure if there are others on staff who know more, I think that if you, and I don't know if it's exactly like this, but where we've had programs that move from a matched program to a block grant program, that a state could be, if we've decreased the amount of federal funds because we've decreased the amount of general funds, then we may be locked into a lower level of federal funding to start with. The reverse of that would be, though, that our general fund maintenance of effort would be lower. So I think the main thing that I can think of right off bat would be where it's been switched from a matched program to a block grant program, that we could be disadvantaged in that regard. Are there any other? I'm looking around to more knowledgeable people who've been around more umpteen years than I have been. I don't see them jumping up. So I think that would be the main area that where we could be disadvantaged.
I think the supplanting of funds or maintenance of effort, no matter what system you're talking about, that the federal government will frown on. I mean, mm-hmm. the objective is that they get the state as a participant or a player, and they don't want you then turning around and using those dollars in order to free up your general fund mm-hmm. dollars. So the supplanting issue has always, and I'm kind of chronologically advantaged like Gene, has been an issue for the in dealing with federal funds. It just categorical funds to me just puts a lot more constraints than if you're talking about if they're a little more lenient in the parameters, and states tend to enjoy that the same as counties enjoy that when we pass down rules and regulations to them. Oregon has become a lot more aggressive in going after the federal dollars, and in fact we've become a lot more creative in the utilization of those federal dollars. When I look, and I know sometimes budget panels are talking about, well, they don't see the interrelationships, but staff has done an incredible job of making sure that we are maximizing the federal dollars and also not supplanting or keeping our maintenance of effort going. And so that's why your budget is so complicated, really, when you begin to step back, because you don't think in terms of education pieces over here that are assisting us over on this side, and yet they do. So,
Madam Chair, I think just to maybe to finish up on a few other things in terms of some of our drivers. As you noticed earlier, two-thirds of those who accessed DHS services in 2001 accessed the health insurance program, the health plan. The cost of health care, not just in the public sector but in the private sector, as you know, has just the last 2 to 3 years especially has really increased rapidly. And especially the cost of pharmaceuticals. And as I mentioned, we have a number of our clients who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. And since Medicare does not pick up pharmaceuticals, that is a huge cost on us. So trying to, it's interesting, although we gained a significant amount of flexibility with our health plan 2 waivers, we will have used up all that flexibility by next month. We started the program this month. We will have used up all the flexibility by next month in terms of dealing with the reduction in benefits. Something that's not on this page, but the chair alluded to it earlier, it's actually, there's a little bit more back on page 22, is litigation. And we have a couple of areas in which there have been significant litigation where we have reached legal settlements over the last few years that are in jeopardy because of some of the budget reductions. The Staley lawsuit, which revolves around providing services to persons who are developmentally disabled in the community. We reached an agreement in 2000 that would phase in new services for more than 5,000 citizens with developmental disabilities over the next several years. Other states have faced enormous costs because they didn't settle lawsuits, and this is in jeopardy right now because of the reductions that we've taken. A second major lawsuit that had been settled was a settlement with the Juvenile Rights Project in 1995 around child welfare. Although we are taking a reduction now in the governor's budget, he does restore $5 million of that, and so we are working with the Juvenile Rights Project to try to maintain our settlement agreement during this period of time. But certainly every time an action is taken, we, as you have probably read in the paper, have had a number of lawsuits filed against us in the last 2 months. And so I told the Department of Justice I thought it was a full employment program for them, but we are, because of the number of legal constraints, either litigation or the threat of it, it certainly begins to constrain some of the choices we can make. Some of the, I had talked already about the economy.
Ms. Carter.
Jean, just one thing. In terms, are these the 5,000 citizens on the wait list, are these people that have never been into the system, that just went out there and we've not served?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I don't know if they've never been in this. Okay. They've had case management in the past, but they may not have had other kinds of support services.
Yeah. So. We've been talking about this group since 1985.
Yeah.
Senator Wardley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you have provided to us on this page are a couple of examples of litigation. Will you be providing to us a detailed list of pending litigation so that we know what the universe looks like?
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we can certainly do that.
Thank you.
It's more than a couple of pages, but we are tracking all of the cases that involve us. Just a couple of other issues, actually, that goes back to the drivers, and I think that we may see over time with the budget reductions that are occurring now and more that will occur in 2003-2005. And that is, as we decrease or don't increase reimbursement for providers, especially for those who have a significant portion of their revenue coming from the Department of Human Services, that may constrain their capacity to provide services. So then you move on to how does that then affect clients' ability to access care. Now, let me use the health plan as an example, because we have to provide, under federal law, reimbursement that's adequate to assure access, reasonable access to care, and we've been challenged in court before on that prior to the Oregon Health Plan. And if people aren't able to access services for providers there, then they may turn to our public health infrastructure. But over the years, our public health infrastructure, we've removed more and more of the safety net from there, and so they're not in a position. And so I think that we will see potentially some issues come out of that. Another issue, and that is we've provided a pretty full continuum of services. Let's use long-term care. Let's use mental health. And that, we have a long ways to go on, even to say a full continuum of services, to say, can we provide less intensive services that may reduce the need for the more intensive services? As we're going through the budget reductions we're experiencing right now, when you've got the choice, I was in a meeting the other day with our local government advisory committee, and one of the local people said, the choice between do I treat someone with a gunshot wound or someone with diabetes? I have to do the triaging. We have to provide the more intensive service. But as we have had to and are going to be eliminating some of those less intensive services, at some point, sometimes sooner and sometimes later, that may manifest itself in terms of coming back and creating increased demand for the more intensive and more expensive services. So it's something that as we look longer term for me is beyond the next 3 or 4 months, but even into the next biennium, we think beyond that, we need to recognize that some of those services that we've had out there, without those there, we will begin to see people coming in and using more intensive and more expensive services. I think that probably, since we're at 3 o'clock, it's probably
a good place
since the time has stopped anyway. And then what we'd like to do tomorrow, we can do whichever order you'd like, is to discuss our what we have as performance measures, how we've been performing, what we see as an impact, and then spend some time talking to you about our reorganization as well.
Representative Bates, he's fine now, and I think that's a good place to begin. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible to have a list of the activities of DHS that are driven by federal statute, by state statute, and then by contract, which becomes the weight of law, that would give us the priorities in the areas in which we really should not tread in looking at making budget adjustments? It would seem to me, Madam Chair, that that would be a helpful thing for us to have, to know. And I know when you say these are examples of litigation, I realize that there needs to be due caution with respect to pending litigation and making representations with respect to the state's positions on those cases. But to have some appreciation as we move along through this process of what those contractual liabilities may be would be very helpful.
I think, Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I'm not sure if doing a list, we can see about doing that, but I think as we come in and the list of priorities that you've asked for, we are doing by program area, and I can ask the assistant directors as they present that to be able to outline of these, which are federal, which are state, which are contractual, and which are ones that we have chosen just as a matter of practice. So we can try to incorporate that as we do our future presentations.
Senator Morris, there is a, and that we're asking all the agencies to put, you know, what the consequences are that would include, you know, whether there's legislation implication, you know, whether there's federal funding match implication, but those kinds of as they develop the priorities, what that means. And if Jean hasn't received hers yet, I know that we've talked about it in our co-chair meeting, to have that kind of information coming back to all the committees, not only just human services, so that we need to know on the basis of which not only the priorities were made, but what the legal implications are, as well as what the federal, the matching situation is, and also the other funds. I think sometimes we forget that picture, too. So we want it as comprehensive of a picture as we could as possible to help us in this decision-making process. And if there's nothing else, do you have anything else, Ms. Hank? We are adjourned until tomorrow at 1 p.m.